Start out with a question this morning. What are you afraid of? Like, what scares you? Is it heights? Like, some people are really, really scared of heights. Heights don't really bother me. Is it like snakes? Right? My wife is terrified of snakes. Maybe it's the dentist, right? For me, it's bats. I'm scared of bats. Now, you guys all might be looking at me like I'm crazy, like, why are you scared of bats? And I think it's because most of you don't have any situations where you have close encounters with bats. But I occasionally have close encounters with bats, and I don't like it. So my job, my other job, is that I work on people's wells and pumps. And if you have a pump or if you don't have a pump, you know that pumps are typically in a pump house. And what a pump house is, it's like a janky shack that is out in the field somewhere that someone shoved insulation in like 4 years ago or 10 years ago and then closed the door and just prayed they'd never have to open it again. And then I have to open it and crawl in there to fix things. And I encounter all sorts of creatures. Rats and mice and snakes and spiders, so many spiders. And people always tell me, they're like, there might be black widows in my pump house. I'm like, no, there are. There are black widows in your pump house. But spiders don't bother me. Like, literally one time, did a job in this pump house, and then I go back to my truck, and I make out a bill, and I'm walking up to the front door, and it's been like 5 or 6 minutes, and I feel something. I go like this, and I throw a gigantic black widow on the ground. Spiders don't bother me. Not that I didn't step on it. But every once in a while, I'll crawl into a pump house and I'll be in there for a minute or two, and then a bat will like explode down from the sky and just freak me out. And I will come out of there screaming like a little girl because they creep me out. I don't know what it is. I had one actually fall on me once. Do you know that, and maybe I'm smart here, because you know that bats are the most common animal in North America to carry rabies, and that the survival rate for rabies is like zero? Like, it is. It's like a 99% fatality rate for rabies. Like, Ebola is like 50%. Rabies, there's only been like 33 cases of people ever surviving rabies. So maybe I'm just smart, right? What scares you? How many of you have heard it said, maybe from a pastor or a sermon sometime, that the most common commandment in the Bible is do not fear? You heard that before? And it might be true. There is time and time and time again in the Bible where it says, do not be afraid. But there's another commandment in the Bible, and it's also about fear, and it's really, really, really common. I've been studying through Psalms the last couple weeks, and I kept seeing this phrase come up over and over and over again, so I started doing some research, and it's this thing about fear that the Bible talks about over and over and over again. Let me give you a few verses, see if you can pick it out. Start with Deuteronomy 5, verse 29. This is God talking to his people through Moses. He says, oh, that they had such a heart as this always, to fear me and to keep all my commandments, that it might go well with them and with their descendants forever. What about 1 Samuel 12, 24? It says this, only fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But it's not just the Old Testament. Look what we see in the New Testament. Luke 1:50, and his mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. Hebrews 12 says this, let us offer to God acceptable worship with fear and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. And as I started studying this, I see that over and over and over again, the Bible holds up this thing that he calls the fear of the Lord and says it's really, really, really important. And it's important for so many reasons. As I started studying through these verses, look here's just an overview of the verses in the Bible that have the phrase the fear of the Lord. And that's not all of them. And as I started reading through all of these, and I read through all of them, I find that it's tied to so many different things. Like the fear of the Lord is tied to radical obedience, but it's also tied to leadership as a requirement. It's tied to all sorts of blessings. It says that there's blessings for people who fear the Lord, from long life to financial blessings. It says that the fear of the Lord will eliminate other fears in our lives, that it can help us believe God's promises, that it gives us wisdom and understanding, it helps us to accept correction, it helps us to value prayer. So many benefits from the fear of the Lord. And the more I read about it, the more I thought, I want more of that in my life. Whatever that is, whatever that phrase means, I want more of it in my life. If it really has all the benefits that the Bible says it has, I want more of it for my friends. If it really does the things the Bible promises it'll do, I want it for my kids. I want it for Edgewater Christian Fellowship. This idea, this concept of the fear of the Lord is so incredibly important. So we're going to spend some time this morning talking about it, what it means, what it doesn't mean, how we might possibly grow in it, the implications of the benefits of it. What does it mean to fear the Lord? And here's the thing, this phrase that the Bible uses over and over again, the fear of the Lord, it doesn't mean a fear as in dread, as in a sense of imminent destruction. And it doesn't mean a fear as in like revulsion, like bats, right? It is a fear that talks about awe and reverence. It's, as one person put it, it's a fear that makes you bow, not a fear that makes you bolt. It doesn't make us flee from God, but does make us stand back and realize who God truly is. The fear of the Lord is this: it's putting God in his proper place and knowing what our proper place is and understanding what the distance between the two of those is. And it's something, as I look around in our culture and as I look around at churches, I just don't think we talk about it very much. Even in church, we don't talk about it very much. The fear of the Lord. Because here's what happens. When I think God, I picture Jesus, which is accurate, but it's not complete, right? Jesus is God having humbled himself and come as a man, having shielded his glory, having shelved his power. And I find myself really comfortable with that Jesus, sitting on the hillside, teaching the people, healing the blind and the sick, the great comforter, the friend of sinners, right? My buddy Jesus. I'm really comfortable with that picture of God. And that's good because that's important and it's accurate. God is all those things, but we have to hold that simultaneously with all the other things that the Bible says about who God is. Right, let me give you some verses. Isaiah 40, so many of them are in Isaiah. So Isaiah 40 says this, God who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens with a span. Isaiah said that God holds the ocean in the cup of his hand. You ever stood by the Pacific Ocean and just thought about how big it is? Our God holds that cupped in his hand. Isaiah says that he spans the universe. Science doesn't know how big the universe is, and science pretends to know everything. In this case, they're just like, I don't know. We're pretty sure it might be infinite. Isaiah goes on in the same chapter in verse 22, it says, he sits above the circle of the earth and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in. Same chapter, a few verses later. Have you not known, have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God. He's eternal. He is both my comforter and Jesus who I can run to, but he's also eternal God, creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint. He does not grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He's all-knowing. He's all-powerful. Look at what it says in Luke. Even the hairs of your head are all numbered. which for some of us is easier than others. But God knows, Jesus, also God, and we have to hold these two at the same time. He knows the number of every hair on every head on earth. Do you know how many that is? I did the math for you. There are 8 billion people, an average of 100,000 hairs per head. So it's this number, 800 trillion. As a side note, that is only one digit less than our national debt. True story. And he knows them all. He is all knowing. But I think my favorite verse about the power of our God is Genesis 1:16. And it's after a few days of creation, and he's made some plants, and he's made the waters, and it says this, "And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. And he made the stars also." It's like an afterthought. He's made all this wonderful stuff. He made grass, he made plants. Oh, and by the way, stars. And the original language here talks about him breathing out stars. The average star, you're gonna get a lot of science today. The average star in our universe holds 1 million Earths. And there are estimated to be 200 billion trillion stars. That's a 2 with 23 zeros behind it. And he made those also. He breathed them out. See, what we have to realize, what to me understanding the fear of the Lord is this, knowing that our God is an ocean-holding, universe-spanning, star-breathing, all-seeing, all-knowing, never-ending creator. That's who he is. That's who we worship. That's who we pray to. That's who hears us. That's who God is. And I have to hold that knowledge simultaneously with the wonderful things I also know about my approachable King Jesus. We've got to hold them both together. It's kind of like the ocean. So I love the ocean. Always love the ocean. I love being in the ocean. I love playing in the ocean. I love swimming in the ocean. So years ago, we took this missions trip down to Mexico, a bunch of high school kids, and we had a couple like sit on top kayaks. And we go down there and the waves are pretty big that day. And I'm like, I'm gonna go out and I'm gonna surf this kayak. It's gonna be awesome. So I get out there and I get ready to ride down a wave. And side note, I don't know how to surf. Important for the story. I know nothing about surfing. I don't realize that at this time, I don't realize that a good surfing wave like kind of curls sideways so you can ride along the wave, because all these waves were just going boom, right? It's a wave, I'm gonna surf it. So I ride this kayak down and I'm way out. I'm 400 or 500 yards out because that's where the waves were. So I ride this kayak down and it nosedives and I come off the front and I hear later from the high school kids that it shot like 12 feet in the air. So my wife and all the kids are there just watching my kayak go bing and then hit the wind and blow, and I come bobbing up and I realize I'm alone. I've got no life jacket. I'm not tied to a surfboard. That leash thing, it's important, right? Would have known that if I was a surfer. And I also realized at that moment that these waves are coming one on top of another. And they're 5-6 foot tall. They're not huge, but they're, I mean, that feels big. And for the first time ever in the ocean, I was scared. Like really, really scared. Like, I don't know if I'm gonna make it to shore. I'm a decent swimmer, but I don't have that kind of endurance. And so I start to panic. And what is the one thing they tell you not to do in a situation like that? Don't panic, which is a ridiculous piece of advice. Hey, you know that thing that every cell in your body wants to do? Yeah, don't do that. Okay, how? Right, so I'm trying to stay calm and I'm swimming and there's a certain point where I'm starting to pray. I'm like, I don't think, I'm not certain I'm gonna make it. I might drown here on a high school youth trip in front of all my high school kids. And then my feet hit the sand. And I walked on shore and pretended like it was no big deal. Because that's what you do as a high school leader. I think it's like that. Now, I like that illustration because it's a good illustration, but part of me doesn't like that illustration because you could think That the point of that story is this: if you don't have awe and reverence for the things that are so much greater than you, you're going to get pummeled. And that is not the point of the illustration. That is not what God is talking about. The point is this: if you don't have awe and reverence for the things that are ultimately larger and more powerful than you are, you're going to make dumb decisions. But if you can hold them, if I can hold the beauty of the ocean with the awe and wonder and respect for its might, then I can enjoy everything the ocean has for me. How much more so with our God? How much more so is it important for me to hold everything I understood about Jesus and how he loves me and he forgives me and he gives me access to the throne with the fact that he is ocean-holding, universe-spanning, star-breathing, all-seeing, all-knowing creator? That's the fear of God, when we understand who he is. Because when we do that, when I can really get that understanding of who my God is to the best of my ability, I think it changes so many things. So what I want to do this morning is just grab a couple Bible stories, just a couple illustrations where I think these characters had an understanding of who God was, and it changed their behavior in a way that I want to model. So the first thing I think that we get when we have an understanding of who God is this: we can become a people of radical obedience. And I think the best story for that is Noah, right? Best story for that is Noah. It says in Hebrews 12 that Noah feared God, and so he obeyed. Because you remember the story of Noah. Noah's sitting there, and God comes to Noah and says, "Noah, I'm going to flood the earth, and I want you to build an ark." And what does Noah say? Okay. Okay. That's radical. Because it had never rained. He's living in a desert. He has no idea how long this is going to take. 100 years, by the way, to build the ark. No further instructions along the way that we see, at least in the story. And people mocking him. "Noah, what are you doing?" But it's a radical obedience. And so often, I don't obey that way, right? If I'm Noah and God comes to me like, "I want to understand all the details of the plan," right? I have trouble obeying if I don't think that, that it's a good plan. And Noah's missing all these pieces. There appears to be no information given to him about how he's supposed to gather all of these animals, right? There's no indication of when the flood's going to happen. But biggest to me, there is no plan that Noah's aware of for how the door is going to get closed. Do you remember that? It says that God closed the, which means that up till that point in time, Noah has no idea how the door is going to get closed. Which, if you know anything about boats, is a problem. If you have a gigantic hole in the side of your boat, it's not a boat, it's a sink. And there's no information given to Noah. But Noah says, "No problem. Okay, Lord." Because Noah doesn't need to know the plan because he knows who the planner is. And I don't know if that's because Noah spent more time outside than we do, and he's looking up the stars and he's looking up at creation. And he's like, "Okay, if the creator of this says he has a plan, I don't need the details because I trust him and I believe him because I have a fear and awe and a reverence for who he is." And I think there's probably some people sitting here today who feel like God has called you to something, and it's big and it's scary, and you don't have all the details, but he's God. He's God. He holds the oceans in the palm of his hand. You don't need the details if you're following him. I also think this thing about radical obedience, that if we really understand this fear of the Lord, it frees us up from having to worry about the consequences of our decisions. So here's what I mean. I was talking to a buddy the other day, and he started a church like 25, 30 years ago, and he's getting a big church, and he's worked so hard and spent so many hours building this congregation. And over the last couple of years, he's just really been praying, like, okay, Lord, how do I transfer out of this? It's time for me to retire. What do I do? And this name kept coming into his head. This person that he'd worked with years, who hadn't talked to the guy in years, connected with him, loved him, but just been disconnected for a long time. But this guy's name keeps coming into his head, This guy and his family don't even live in the United States. They are across the ocean. My buddy believes God. He has a fear of the Lord and how great he is. Hey, if God keeps bringing that to my mind, then whatever that means, I'm going to have to step out and walk in that. So he calls the guy up. Hey, I know this is crazy, but I've been praying about having someone take over my church, and I'm thinking it's you. And the guy's like, you're kidding me, right? He's like, no, I'm not kidding. He goes, because 45 minutes ago, my wife and I were talking about moving back to the United States, and we were like, where would we want to move? And the city we picked is where your church is. So he knows that he's walking in obedience to the Lord, right? Now, fast forward a year and a half, this guy's taken over the church, and he's making a ton of changes. Changes that might have been difficult for this man who had poured his life into this church. They're not like heretical changes, they're more practical changes, but they're things that he thought were important to pour into, and now they're being eliminated. And I was talking to him, and he was just totally okay with it. And I'm like, how are you okay with that? And he goes, because I know that God wanted him to do it. See, when we walk in obedience, when he turns this thing over, then we don't have to worry about the results, right? Our job is obedience. God's job is results. I think it frees us up so much. Because here's the thing. Very often in my life, I've known the right thing to do and not done it. Not done it because I was selfish or because I didn't want to disappoint someone, or I didn't want to ruffle feathers, or I chose the path of least resistance. And most of those times in my life, I was like, well, I can either do the easy thing or I can disappoint my buddy Jesus. And I was like, well, buddy Jesus, I'll go with the easy thing because I missed it. It's not the easy thing or it's the easy thing or disappointing the ocean holding, universe spanning, star breathing, all seeing, all knowing, never ending creator God. And that makes my decision making so much easier. Who are you going to obey? That guy. That's who I want to obey. That's who I want to follow. So I think it helps us to have radical obedience. I also think it helps us to accept correction. And I think the story here that I love is Jeremiah. It's from Jeremiah chapter 26. And here's what happens in this story. Jeremiah comes up. He comes to a group of Israelites who are not doing the right things. And he says, hey, you need to repent or destruction is coming. You need to change your ways because it's what God wants for you. And I think about how many times in my youth I sat out in church and felt like God was speaking exactly that type of message to me. Maybe you've sat out there and heard the same thing. Maybe you're here today and you feel like that sermon you heard maybe a couple weeks ago, maybe today, maybe next week, it's God calling you into correction, to walk away from some sin you've been unwilling to give up, to confess something you've been hiding, to forgive that person that you have so much anger to end that relationship, right? Maybe God has been speaking to you every Sunday when you've been here saying, listen, you've got one foot in the world and one foot in my kingdom, and you need to choose. Maybe God's calling yourself to deny yourself fully and follow him. Ever sat out in church and felt like that message was for you, that God was speaking a word of correction into your life? That's what Jeremiah does in 26. And I think way too often I've responded the way the people respond in Jeremiah 26, and they're like, we don't want to hear that, Jeremiah. I've blamed the messenger. I've said, you know what, it's an old book, it's outdated information. And what they do in Jeremiah 26 is they decide, we're going to kill Jeremiah, which is way worse than those nasty emails that the pastors get every once in a while. So that's nice. They're going to kill Jeremiah. We don't like your word of correction. And Jeremiah says, it's not from me, it's from the Lord. And then the elders of the community come out and they say, listen, this is the Lord speaking, not Jeremiah. And if we fear the Lord, then we won't put Jeremiah to death. And they release Jeremiah that day. Because the thing is, when you're sitting out there and you feel that thing in your spirit, maybe you're feeling it today, maybe you know. Man, I remember sitting in church week after week after week, hearing God speak something to me and me just being like, nope, I don't wanna. You know how hard that's gonna be? You know how difficult that would be? And so I didn't. I think I missed out. Because we have to remember who it is that's convicting our hearts. It might be like this. So I've recently picked golf back up. I took a long time off golf and I'm playing golf again. And I realized something that I had known but I had forgotten. See, golf is the only sport I've ever been involved in where people who are significantly worse than you feel completely free to give you advice. It's just like a guy will tell you how to fix your swing right before he steps up and like shanks his fourth one out of bound. Like it's a golf thing. So no one listens to anybody. They don't. But what if I'm standing up there and I make a swing and it's terrible, and then I turn around and out comes Tiger Woods. And he's like, hey, if you try this, it'll work better. Am I gonna listen? Absolutely, because the authority of the advice giver has a lot to do about whether or not I'm gonna receive that correction, doesn't it? That conviction you're feeling, that thing that you know God wants you to change, that is being spoken to you by the ocean holding, universe spanning, all knowing, all seeing, never ending creator God. Take the advice. Make the change. Because God knows and he wants the best for you. Right? So I think it can help us have radical obedience. It can help us accept correction. The third thing I think it can do is I think it helps us to believe God's promises. And I like Abraham for this one. Because you remember the story. God comes to Abraham and says, Abraham, I'm going to make you into a great nation. And Abraham says, I don't know if you know this, but my wife and I can't actually even have kids. So, and what does it say? It says that God takes him outside and says, Abram, look up at the stars. You ever been outside on a really dark night and seen the stars and just marveled at them? And he says, Abram, number them if you can. That's how many your descendants will be. Did God really want Abram to count the stars? Or did God want to remind Abram that he made the stars? Right? Because understanding, because here's the thing about Abram. It wasn't just that he needed to believe that God was willing to fulfill that promise. He needed to believe that God was able to fulfill that promise. Okay, so it's like this. Maybe you're eighth floor, trapped in a burning building. No escape. And all of a sudden you hear the door get busted down. And you hear someone come in and be like, don't worry, I'm gonna get you out of here. And you turn around and look up and there's a guy who's like 5'1", like 101 pounds. Looks like he spent the majority of high school getting swirlies. You want to believe him. You really, really do. But you're not 100% sure that he has the power to fulfill that promise. But what if you turn around and busting through the door is some 6'6" dude who looks like he lives on protein shakes and T-bones, right? He's an ex-linebacker and he's like, don't you worry, I'm getting you out of here. You're like, yes, I believe you. You are capable of that. I'm not worried anymore. I think we need to hold that fear of the Lord about who he really, really is in order to be able to believe his promises, because sometimes they're so hard to believe. Sometimes when you see that promise that says, I will make beauty from ashes, and you're standing in the pit of your burned down life, you say, how can you possibly do that, Lord? Because he holds the ocean in the palm of his hand, because he spans the universe. That's how he can make beauty from ashes. How can you give me rest? I'm so weary with this life. Because he's all-knowing and all-seeing. That's who our God is. That's who's making the promise. He is my buddy Jesus, and he's approachable, and he's my comforter, but he's also all-powerful, all-knowing, all-seeing God. That's who's promised to carry you out of the fire. And you can trust it, and you can believe it. What about when you look around and you're just like, I don't know what's going on with the world, Lord. I don't get it. It is falling apart, and then you read, I go to prepare a place for you. This isn't your home, and you go, I see what you made, and I can believe that. I can trust that. I can believe your promises because I am trying to wrap my head around your power. And even though I can't get it completely, I'm focused on it now, Lord, and I get it. You are the God capable of doing those things. I think finally, it can give us a higher value for prayer. So Jehoshaphat, 2 Chronicles chapter 20. This is such a cool story, by the way. If you're a family that likes to do Bible stories with your kids at night, 2 Chronicles 20, hidden gem. It's super cool. So there's this King Jehoshaphat, and here's what happens. He's a good king. He's a godly king. And all of a sudden, all of his advisors run up to him, and they're like, listen, we're being invaded. The Moabites, the Ammonites, and some of the Mennonites are coming. And it is an overwhelming army. And it is an impossible situation. And so a king in Jehoshaphat's position there really only has two choices, practically speaking. The first thing he can do is he can compromise. He can go out and he can meet that advancing army and be like, okay, what do you want? Do you want this chunk of land? Do you want this? I can sacrifice and compromise to get you to go away. And I think that we do the same thing. We can sit here in our lives and be looking at what looks like an impossible situation, and our first reaction is to compromise. Look, I know we're not married, but the availability of rentals and the cost of rent, and there's no other option but for us to move into with each other. We know it's a compromise, but it's the only thing we can do. Like, I can't speak up about what's going on at work or talk about that policy because I might lose my job, and if I lose my job, it's my only option. I'm just going to have to make this small compromise right now. I don't know if I can pay my taxes and pay my bills. So I'm just gonna make up a couple deductions here. It's okay, everybody does it. He could compromise. That's one option that Jehoshaphat has. The other option is to surrender. To surrender to what seems like an impossible situation. And I see believers do this all the time. I'm just gonna surrender to that sin that's owning me. I can't fight it anymore. I don't think I'll ever break out of this addiction. What's the point? I'm just going to continue to do it again. You know what? I'm so tired of fighting for this marriage. I'm just going to file for divorce. I'm just going to surrender. That's Jehoshaphat's other option. When you stand back and look at this story from a practical worldview, those are Jehoshaphat's only two options. You compromise or you surrender. But Jehoshaphat doesn't do either of those. He gathers all the people together and he says, we're going to pray. And it says in Jehoshaphat, or 2 Chronicles 20, verse 12, that Jehoshaphat stood in front of the people and says, O Lord, we do not know what to do, but our eyes are on you. Jehoshaphat knew, that's not my only option. Compromise or surrender are not my only option because I know who my God is. And if you follow the rest of that story, God says, you know what? I'm not even gonna have you fight in this battle. Like, it's so interesting when you read through the Old Testament stories, the way that God shows up time and time again. And sometimes there's, you know, lamps, and he has all sorts of ways of winning battles. And oftentimes he has the people participating. But in this one, he's like, you know what? Don't even worry about it. He goes, I'm going to make those armies so confused that when you show up tomorrow, they will have all killed each other. And they do. They show up and all of them had killed each other. And then it says it took them 3 days to collect the spoils, the jewels and the gold that were left. Because our God is a God who can say, you think it's impossible, and yet I have a field of jewels for you. But you got to pray. And we have to value that. And when I understand who hears my prayers, that he is the ocean holding, universe spanning, all-knowing, all-seeing, all-powerful creator God, that that's who's listening to my prayers, how much more do I value them? How much more is that my first reaction? Because all too often in my life, I'm like, well, compromise didn't work, and surrender has gotten me beat up, so I guess I'll try prayer. It should be our first reaction when we understand who God is. Right? And that's four of them. We've got obedience, we've got correction, we've got God's promises, we've got valuing prayer. There are so many others. There's these verses about how the fear of the Lord will give you insight and wisdom. There's these verses about how it's important for leadership. There's this entire section about how having the fear of the Lord eliminates other fears. Right? That's David. Everyone's afraid of Goliath except for David, because David knows who his God is. He's like, how can I be afraid of that dude? I have God on my side, right? So if this is so important, then the question that comes to me is this, how can we grow in this? Is this actually an area of my life that I can grow in? And I think it is, because I've grown in it in these last few weeks. And what's interesting is that all of the things that I read, all those verses about who God is, they weren't new to me. I grew up in church. I know this about God. I believe it, but I don't spend any time thinking about it. I know it, but I don't meditate on it. I think about Jesus, and I love that and following him, but I don't spend much time praising the nature of who my God is. And over these last couple weeks, as I've been thinking about this and studying it, I've been doing that. I've been driving down the street and looking at a tree and be like, you made that, right? Like, I was in my mom's garden the other day and I picked an apple and I ate it. And I'm like, this is better than any dessert I've ever made in my entire life. And you invented it for us. Because I think one of the best things we can do is get out into nature, because it'll give us this awe and this wonder for who God is. And we take the time to do it. Take the time to do it with your kids, right? Just the other day, my son comes in and he's like, Dad, I took a picture of the moon. It's so cool. You want to come out and see the moon? And I'm like, I've seen the moon, like a lot. Every night, 40 years. I could do the math. But I've been thinking about this. So I go out and I sit on our front lawn and I look at the moon and I tell my son, hey, did you know that the moon is perfect? That God made the moon absolutely perfect? That if it was any larger or any smaller or any further away or any closer, it would be almost impossible for there to be life on earth? That our God made that. And I knew that because I'd been doing all these YouTube searches on the amazing things about creation, and you know, the internet, it knows what you like, so it's popping up more things. So I got a video about how incredible the moon is instead of a video about like why the ducks were gonna win. Because I've been focused on this. I think it's so beautiful. And then I think the other thing that we can do, sorry, guys, I got carried away. I told them to come up when I started talking about that, but I was wrong. I have more to say. I think the other thing that we can do is to really remember the great things that God did. I can't tell you how many of these chapters that talk about the fear of the Lord include a remembrance to the great things that God has done. Because every once in a while, when I'm faced with an impossible task, what I need to do is remember how my Creator got me through the last impossible task. And remember that. And remind myself, but also remind my family. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I don't have a practical solution yet, but maybe you'll have one, or maybe you'll come up with it, or maybe something we can all think about. But over and over again in the Old Testament, you see these miracles, and then God had them build a physical remembrance. And it says so that when your children ask you about that, you can tell them what God did, right? Like, it hasn't happened to me. I was just trying to think of like a practical illustration. Like maybe there was a time in your life where literally the only thing left in your fridge was a bottle of ketchup. And you prayed and you knew, and now you've seen God come through and move you in this new way, and you still have that bottle of ketchup. And your parents or kids are like, why is that there? Because let me tell you. Let me tell you about the time. I don't know how we do that practically, but I think there's something there. Maybe that's a future sermon. I think we need to remember who God was. But I think my favorite thing about having meditated over the last few weeks about the greatness and glory and the fear of God is it's made me value so much more what Jesus did when he came here, when he humbled himself to save me. It's what we remember every time we take communion.